Welcome to Bedside Reading, the podcast where each episode I interview somebody about a book, a novel, a poetry collection, a memoir or biography. Not traditional medical textbooks. And we explore the themes within which help make us better healthcare professionals. It's a bit like accidental CPD. Take us for a walk or a run. Snuggle up with a cup of tea on the sofa, maybe with a lap full of kittens. Listen on your way to work and add some immersive CPD, as well as getting some ideas for your to-read pile. Please let me know if you're enjoying the podcast. Rate us, review us. This really helps the algorithms of podcasting to suggest us to other people who haven't found us yet. Find us on Twitter, @BedsidePodcast, on Instagram, @BedsideReadingPodcast. And if there's a book you're desperate to come on the show to discuss, please do get in touch on Twitter, Insta, or by emailing bedsidereadingpodcast@gmail.com. I'm Tara George, a GP, medical educator, and compulsive reader and book buyer. This is Bedside Reading. It's a joy today to welcome back Kirsty Shires to Bedside Reading. Kirsty and I first connected last year over Michael Rosen's Many Different Kinds of Love, and she emailed me a few weeks ago to tell me about a book that she thought I ought to read, which actually I had read before many years ago, and I've absolutely loved coming back to be thinking about. That book is Anne Fadiman's The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down, which is the story of a Hmong refugee family and their daughter Leah in California in the early 90s, and some of the culture clash and culture shock that exists between their understanding of their daughter's condition, epilepsy, which in their language means the spirit catches you and you fall down, and her American doctors. It is a phenomenal read, and it was wonderful to talk to Kirsty today about some of the themes from it and what we've both learnt and what we've changed in our practice as a result of having read it. Kirsty, welcome back to Bedside Reading.
And thank you, and thank you for having me back, and I'm pleased to be here.
So it's so nice to be talking to you again, and I have to say, doing this podcast is a joy for so many reasons, not least that I get to talk about books, which is just fabulous. But when guests who've been on before drop me an email and say, have you read this book? I really want to talk about it. Can I come back? That actually makes me so unbelievably happy. And that's how today has ended up happening. So thank you, Kirsty.
And I'm pleased that you were pleased to welcome me back. Thank you.
So before we go on and talk about a fabulous book, The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down, would you like to introduce yourself so my listeners know who I'm talking to today?
So I'm Kirsty Shires. I'm a salaried GP in the West Midlands. I'm also a GP mentor and appraiser. I have got a background in undergraduate medical education at Birmingham Medical School. My focus really, I think, is how we bring kindness and compassion into our work, both with our patients and also with ourselves, you know, and colleagues and well-being, and how we look after one another.
Fantastic. And we first met on the podcast back in 2023, so about a year ago, talking about Michael Rosen's Many Different Kinds of Love, which I adored. And I must say, I have just finished listening to the audiobook of his newest book, Getting Better, which is an absolute delight.
I read it last year, and it is, again, sort of a very fascinating book, and he's such a wise man, and you know, there's so much in Getting Better actually to talk about as well, but we probably need to stick to our topic, but that's a great read as well.
And how much do you find yourself using books in your work, particularly either teaching work or clinical work? Is there a crossover for you?
Very definitely. I sort of do a mixture of reading. So I've usually got a fiction book on the go, a non-fiction book on the go. Sometimes I've also got something going on Audible as well for in the car. So trying to keep track of them all can be a little bit tricky, but different frames of mind, you know, you're in a different mood for things. I think in fiction books, you can find so much about life and relationships and what makes people tick, that there's always something it seems to me, that talks about the human condition, I suppose. And then as a GP, I'm dealing with human beings, you know, in all sorts of circumstances, you know, and different times of their life. And I think sometimes the books that I've read have sort of helped me, you know, to relate to that. And then non-fiction wise, there are often, they are kind of slightly medically themed or psychologically themed, I'd say. And again, trying to learn more about what makes people tick. So I think it just seems to come into it at all times. And even at times where I've been sort of not myself, low, you know, I've actually always kept reading. It is still something that I've always read. And I can't imagine not.
Do you ever recommend books to patients?
Sometimes I do. I suppose probably more so, you know, perhaps a self-help type book, in all honesty. I haven't recommended too many sort of fiction books to patients. I recommend lots of books to sort of friends and colleagues, but not so much to patients, actually. Although if I see that somebody has been waiting in the waiting room for a little while for me, because I might be running late, and they've got a book with them, I might ask them what it is that they're reading. And so sometimes I have spoken about books with patients.
And I find that such a lovely opener, isn't it, when somebody comes in with a book, especially if it's something that I think, oh, I've heard of that, I might be going to read it, or I have actually read it. Mm. I think it's just an instant rapport builder.
It's such a connection, isn't it?
I always feel very grateful to a patient many years ago now, where I went on a home visit and she was sat in bed. She was nearly bedbound, and she had, I can't remember which book it is now, but it was one of the Kate Morton novels. Mm-hmm. And it was in hardback. It had literally come out that week, and it was this huge hardback. And she said, oh gosh, it's really making my shoulders ache, but it's absolutely brilliant. And I said, oh, I do love Kate Morton. And I said, I'm a bit too much of a cheapskate to buy all that much brand new in hardback, but I'm really looking forward to it. Is it worth looking forward to? And she was like, oh gosh, it's absolutely fantastic. And then about a week and a half later, her daughter arrived at reception with a carrier bag with the book and a note from the patient saying, my house is so cluttered, I always give books to charity. I'm not saying that you're a charity, but read it first and then pick the charity shop of your choice to hand it on to. And that was so kind of her.
That's so lovely. Yeah.
So coming on to The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down, I'm wondering, what was it that made you pick it up in the first place?
It was actually given to me by a friend who is a therapeutic radiographer. And I'm not sure how she'd come across it, to be honest, and I need to ask her that. but she read it and she thought that I would really enjoy it. So she gave me a copy. I'd not heard of it before. There was so much in there that I didn't know about, you know, the history of Laos and its connections with America in the Vietnam War, and then sort of refugee population that came over. So those bits were sort of fascinating. What unfolds with the young girl, you know, in there who, you know, starts to develop epilepsy, and the sort of cultural clash between the medical team in their locality and the sort of the culture of the people that she comes from, and how that has so many resonances really for our practice in so many ways. Yeah, not just when cultures clash, but when ideologies clash, health beliefs clash.
And I was thinking, I read this a long time ago for the first time. And I was thinking, I think probably around 2005 or 2006. And I was in the position of, I had travelled to Laos, and I went when I was an undergraduate, one university summer holiday, and absolutely loved the country. And I'm puzzled because I can't work out why or how I came to read this in the first place. And I'm assuming that I must have been in a bookshop and seen that it was something to do with Laos and thought, oh, actually that is having a connection. And actually it's been lovely to go back to it again in preparation for today. I think in the context of thinking about history. And I think one of the things I love about the book is there is the biography of a fascinating family. Mm-hmm. There is a lot to learn about medical and over-medicalized culture. There's a lot about culture clashes. This is probably, maybe it's best described as a work of anthropology. Mm-hmm. But I think also there's a lot about the history, and particularly about, you know, the conflicts in Indochina, and thinking about particularly the Hmong people, who I hadn't come across before, and the Vietnam War and the role of the West in Vietnam, which I've started thinking a lot more about. And because I love mentioning other things, there are a couple of Vietnamese novels, one which actually I'm going to be discussing in my book group this evening, which is called The Mountains Sing, which I quite enjoyed. And then another, which is called Banyan Moon, which absolutely blew me away, which I think is a debut novel, which I was lucky enough to get a pre-publication copy of last year. It is now out in the world. Yeah, it's been really nice to think about that and actually just recognise that I think sometimes as doctors, we think we're quite well educated. And actually, I mean, nobody can know everything about the world, but actually reminds me that the world is a very small place and actually I'm quite ignorant quite a lot of the time.
And yeah, I mean, I think it is. And that's one of the joys of books, actually, isn't it? Is that ability to step into other worlds and find out about other places without, you know, sort of necessarily having to go there. And I'm not saying that's a substitute, you know, I'm not, you know, actually going and experiencing is different, isn't it? But it can get us to places in our imagination. I think it really helps us to put ourselves in somebody else's shoes. You know, I used to sort of quote to the first year medical students from Harper Lee, To Kill a Mockingbird, you know, Atticus Finch telling the children, you never know a person until you can step into his shoes and walk around in them. And I think, you know, I think books can give you that that ability and that insight.
And for people who haven't come across this book, because it is quite niche, and I love the fact that actually over the last few years, every so often people go, oh, have you come across this? And I've then very smugly gone, yeah. I think every so often people do read it, and I've never met anybody that's read it and hasn't thought it was brilliant. But tell us a little bit about, yeah, what is this book actually about?
So it's the story of a young child who is born in America in a refugee community in a, I would say it's a fairly sort of small town, you know, small poor town in America, the local hospital. There's two very well-meaning and very clever paediatricians, you know, I think who work there. This young girl's born to this Hmong family. So there's her and her parents, and there are some other children, and I can't remember quite how many other children there are. But an incident happens, and Leah Lee, the little girl, she starts to develop seizures, and the family sort of take her to the hospital. Their belief, am I allowed to kind of give it away?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So their belief, though, is that one of the other siblings had slammed the door, and that had meant that Leah's spirit had flown away from her. And so this was the problem. Obviously, that doesn't fit with the biomedical model of epilepsy and seizures. And therein sort of starts and sort of, it does become a battle really between the family and the medical team about what's best for Leah. And so medication is prescribed, but the family, you know, want to use their own cultural practices, sort of sacrificing chickens and pigs and, you know, sort of different things. But, you know, they and they feel that there's sort of too much medicine being given, and that, you know, that this is actually potentially harming her. So to the medics, it kind of looks like they're being non-compliant with treatment, and not giving her the medicine, and then she keeps coming in with further seizures. But to the family, they're not being able to explain, you know, their point of view and what's actually happening. I think that's probably fair to say. And then the story continues to unfold over a number of years, where then obviously the children's services get involved, and Leah's removed for a while from the family and goes to a foster family. And then she has a, and again, I'm trying to remember the timeline. So I apologize if I've sort of got it wrong, but she has a major epileptic seizure, which actually then means that she sort of can no longer talk, walk. And she does return to the family, and there's so much kind of love and care that's given to her. But it's just that the whole sort of, you know, I think everybody involved feels devastated by it. I think the medical team feel devastated because they feel like if their treatments had been adhered to, this would never have happened. The family, you know, they do feel devastated, but they're also just so loving towards this little girl and what she can still give to them. And that she, there's a part in it, I think, where they say, you know, she always knew how to receive love. The little girl did, and she carried on knowing how to give and receive love. And I thought that was lovely. So I think that's the sort of synopsis of it. I mean, there's lots more to it, in terms of really in depth looking at the cultures, and you know, there's the time where they do actually get a sort of, I can't remember if she's a nurse or a social worker who really tries to link up with the family and make some connections, and that makes quite a difference for some time, I think, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I think that for me, I think was really important. And I think perhaps we need to be slightly forgiving of the culture clash and say this book came out in 1997. And I hope we've moved some way on from this. But I think even revisiting it now, there is a sense of, I think this could still happen, which sort of gave me a bit of a chill. And I think there is something about the social worker who they assign to the family who actually wants to understand. And I think we often talk about, you know, communication difficulties, don't we? Mm-hmm. And we pay lip service to it by, we say, oh, we must get interpreters, we must ensure that people's voices are heard. But actually, I feel one of the things that has really struck me about this book is that idea of an understanding deficits. Mm. And that is much, much deeper than hearing the words. Actually, really, truly understanding and believing their perspective.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And it sort of obviously fits when there's this sort of change in culture, you know, and there's, you know, completely different sort of belief systems. But it also happens when, you know, patients have got a completely different view to ours about what's causing their illness. You know, I'm thinking about kind of medically unexplained symptoms, but even other things, you know, sometimes it's just that gap, that sort of, you know, of well, what's causing it. And, you know, we have a very Western biomedical model of illness. In general practice, I think we do try to look more holistically with the biopsychosocial model. So we know that there's more to it than just simple, you know, sort of pathogen causes disease, we find a cure for it. The mind-body connection, I think, is much deeper than we understand. I think there's an emerging field, you know, of psychoneuroimmunology that's starting to find some physiology behind it, and that may help our Western minds, you know, sort of accept, you know, the bigger spiritual sense of health, if you like. But so many cultures have that holistic view and that spiritual view, and that, you know, the balance of things being so important. And I think we're all have probably seen things where you think this person's never going to get better, this is really awful, and yet they rally through somehow and something happens. And we've all seen the person who hangs on until a particular family member comes back, you know, before they choose their moment to die. You know, there are things that we can't explain, you know. And I think being able to be open to different cultures and different ideas is actually really important. It's just, I think it's time, isn't it, probably, that is our worst enemy with this. Time and patience to sort of to understand it.
And I think there is something about time and patience. I think there's perhaps also something which is less easy to admit to, which is that idea that part of our role as a healthcare professional, and I think perhaps particularly as doctors, but I suspect it may well affect other colleagues too, is that sense that we are supposed to be the knowing one. And we are supposed to be right. And of course, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, managing uncertainty and shared decision making. And I personally think that's enormously liberating, because then I don't have to be, inverted commas, the grown up in every situation. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there is something that is immensely challenging to the egos of a lot of doctors being confronted with, no, actually, you're not right. No, you don't know. No, actually, there is another viewpoint and you need to listen to this. And an awful lot of the way that we, I say we're trained, because I'm involved in undergraduate education now and I think it is better, has been about you are the all-knowing doctor and you are the person who is in charge here. And quite clearly, that is often not the case.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in the book, the paediatricians, you know, are so fused with their model, you know, that they can't sort of see it. And there's a really powerful set of questions that I think he's a psychiatrist and medical anthropologist at Harvard Medical School, Arthur Kleinman, sort of came up with, which in terms of general practice training, I've described it to people as ICE, you know, the ideas, concerns and expectations, ICE on steroids, really, because it's such a sort of powerful way of getting to it. And is it okay if I sort of just say what those questions are?
Absolutely. And I think I want to say that, you know, as a medical educator, and I'm a GP and I'm a TPD and I've taught communication skills at undergraduate level, postgraduate level, all sorts of things. And clearly I've read this book before and had clearly forgotten about these. This blew me away because I look at them and I go, why on earth are we not teaching these? So yes, let's go through them because I think they are really, really important. And you know, anybody that's listening wanting some accidental CPD, this might just change your life.
Yeah, so the first question is, what do you call the problem? And so the response in this, if the parents would have said, is, I can't pronounce it, but quag dab peg, that means the spirit catches you and you fall down. So that's what they would have called her seizure. What do you think has caused the problem? And for them, it was soul loss. Why do you think it started when it did? Leah's sister, Yer, slammed the door and Leah's soul was frightened out of her body. What do you think the sickness does? How does it work? It makes Leah shake and fall down. It works because a spirit called a dab is catching her. How severe is the sickness? Will it have a short or long course? And the answer to this I love, which is, why are you asking us those questions? If you are a good doctor, you should know the answers yourself. Number six, what kind of treatment do you think the patient should receive? What are the most important results you hope she receives from this treatment? So you should give Leah medicine for a week, but no longer. And after she's well, she should stop taking it. And then they talk about, you know, the sort of sacrificing things that would go into it. We hope Leah will be healthy, but we are not sure we want her to stop shaking forever because it makes her noble in our culture. And when she grows up, she might become a shaman. And question 7, what are the chief problems the sickness has caused? It has made us sad to see Leah hurt, and it has made us angry at Yer. And what do you fear most about the sickness? That Leah's soul will never return. And in the book, the anthropologist, you know, who's writing it, she presented those questions back to the paediatricians, and they were sort of like, they thought, what? Ah, right. And then suddenly they got this insight into that was what was going on. And actually what they were trying to do was kind of coerce the family into their model, you know. And as you're talking about shared decision making, what they needed was to get to that shared decision. And again, perhaps we think the shared decision is all about us and how we explain it, but it's as much about how we listen to the person's wants and needs and what's important to them, you know, as it is. Yeah. And I just think those questions are just really key. And, you know, if we've got a patient who has got medically unexplained symptoms, we're, you know, or we're just at cross paths about how we're going to manage it. I think that, you know, what kind of treatment do you think the patient should receive, and what are the most important results you hope she receives from the treatment? And that's because it gives you so much insight, doesn't it?
I think it really does, because I think it is so easy to work on an assumption that if somebody is having seizures, that the goal of treatment is to stop them having seizures, because that is absolutely based in, you know, the biomedical model. And I think for somebody who isn't open to really stepping to a side and listening to a completely different perspective, it's almost to go, but I don't need to ask. Of course we want to get rid of these seizures. And then realizing that for the Hmong people, the seizures are the sign of some kind of spiritual divinity, and that actually this whole, well, she might be a shaman. And this could be really, really important. And I think that suddenly gets you to go, oh my goodness, because again, it's just really easy to go, well, why on earth wouldn't this? And it's actually, we need to ask the question, don't we? We need to ask, and we need to be open. And I come back again and again to one of my very, very favorite quotes about empathy, which comes from Brené Brown, which is that we need to dispel the myth that empathy is walking in someone else's shoes, which I suppose is the start, and there's the Atticus Finch quote that you came up with before. It says, rather than walking in your shoes, I need to learn how to listen to the story you tell about what it's like in your shoes and believe you, even when it doesn't match my experiences.
Yeah, and I think that's the key, isn't it? Yeah. And kind of into a linked sort of book, Colin Grant, who's a journalist, broadcaster, and has written a number of sort of books and memoirs. He's written a book called The Smell of Burning, which is a memoir of epilepsy, which is dedicated to his brother who had epilepsy and actually died of SUDEP, you know, sudden unexpected death in epilepsy. And he does a sort of a history of epilepsy, how it's regarded in different cultures, historical people who it's now thought, you know, did they have some form of epilepsy? And, you know, he speaks to various people who have epilepsy about their experiences and what it's like to have a seizure and how you might feel after a seizure, and how some people, you know, it forms part of their identity. And again, I think, you know, when we're doing epilepsy reviews and things, there's probably whole heaps of things that we don't ask or don't really consider. And there's a piece in that book where his brother goes along to the GP, and he goes and sits with him, and they're trying to understand why his brother isn't always taking his medication, you know, and it's looking at the compliance. And his brother Christopher sort of tries to explain this by, he talks a notion of a Native American Hopi word, which I'm going to mispronounce, Koyaniskatsi. but it means life out of balance. And he felt that the medication reduced him, kind of left him with a feeling of living a life out of sync or out of harmony. And he's trying to explain that. And the GP's thoughts were elsewhere. He didn't respond, you know, the GP just looked up from the computer screen and said, "What dose of sodium valproate are you on?" And just hadn't met him at the same page at all. And I can empathise with the doctor, you know, you've got your 10 minutes to do your epilepsy review probably, and you want to solve the problem of, you know, why is this person not taking their tablet? And you don't want to have a philosophical discussion about it. But sometimes those philosophical discussions are exactly what we need to make that connection with the patient.
And I think that is the problem, that so much of what we do is really complex. And actually there are those situations where a really transactional solution is never going to be the answer for this patient.
Yeah.
But I think whilst we continue to train clinicians in a, you know, okay, we've moved from the biomedical to the biopsychosocial model. But still, I think if we look at something like the quality and outcomes framework with epilepsy, you know, all of those things, you're looking at, you know, are people concordant with their medication and are they seizure free? And that is the goal of treatment. And quite mm-hmm. clearly, we know that, you know, if people are having lots of seizures, maybe that is affecting their quality of life, maybe placing them at increased risk of sudden death and any of those other things. But it becomes this really binary. Are you having fits or not? Okay, you are having fits. Let's up your meds. And actually, that stops seeing people as individuals. But you can see how and why it happens, not mm-hmm. least if it is, you know, it's some of it is around targets, but some of it is around actually we are often very ill-equipped to have those philosophical and spiritual dimension mm-hmm. conversations with patients.
Yeah, and some of us are going to feel more comfortable than others about it, and because we're individual human beings as well, you know. It's fascinating. It's, you know, it is fascinating, and this is why I love general practice and medicine, is actually the different conversations that you sometimes just have with patients and the things you find out about them that you wouldn't have anticipated, you know, and you never know what hidden depths people have got.
Well, Kirsty, thank you so much for suggesting The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down. It's been fabulous to revisit it, just reading wise, but it's been wonderful talking to you today about it.
Thank you so much. And thanks for having me. And I hope a few more people, you know, might pick it up and read it and enjoy it. Yeah.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Bedside Reading. If you're enjoying the podcast, please do rate us, review us using whichever podcast platform you listen on. It really does help other people to find us. If there's a book you've enjoyed that we haven't yet discussed and you'd like to come on as a guest, please do get in touch, either via X, formerly Twitter, Insta, or by email. Bedside Reading is hosted by Tara George and produced by Levi G.